This episode may contain material which may be unsuitable for some listeners.
Peter Nygaard is a serial sex criminal who openly flaunted horrendous deviant sexual behavior for decades.
The star, watch out for her.
This is your new home right here.
Oh, awesome. I'm gonna be here all the time, Dave.
That's what I want. Here, come over here.
Remember Gabby?
At 83, he's spending the remaining years of his life behind bars in Canada. He's been sentenced to 11 years in prison following guilty verdicts on 4 counts of sex assault going back as far as the late 80s. In January of 2025, he's scheduled to face trial again, this time in Montreal, on 1 count of sex assault and forcible confinement. After that, there's another sex assault trial awaiting him in Winnipeg. And once he clears that trial, it's off to New York to face a daunting federal trial in the US. And as if that's not enough, there is also a whopping class action civil suit that will kick in once all the criminal litigation wraps up. A suit where at last count, 135 women allege that he attacked them too. But these cases only scratch the surface of the rape and sex trafficking that Nygaard is alleged to have committed over a half century.
We do the real people. That's our marketplace. You will not find another product as competitively priced as ours.
Welcome back to Uncle Peter, a Drop Dead Serious podcast. Thousands and thousands of women who voluntarily went to bed with Peter Nygaard.
Over the years, yep.
Thousands.
Thousands.
And how many do we think did not sleep with him voluntarily?
You're in some big numbers.
Big territory.
Yeah.
Over the years. And maybe, I dare say, thousands.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair number.
That's Angela Dyborn, Peter Nygaard's niece, a Nygaard Industries employee for decades, and also my childhood best friend. Angela is sharing her story for the first time here on the Uncle Peter podcast. She and I spent hours discussing her life inside the Nygaard family and the Nygaard empire. Her stories are shocking, unpleasant, and at times downright disturbing. In this episode of Uncle Peter, you'll also hear from Greg Gutzler, the attorney for well over 100 Nygaard victims.
I've talked to all 135 of my clients, and I will tell you this, that I am absolutely certain that there are many, many, many more survivors that are out there.
The Nygaard clothing empire, built from scratch back in 1967, was once estimated to be worth nearly $1 billion. But today, Nygaard International is bankrupt. It was liquidated back in 2020. All because of the unbridled ego of its founder and his insatiable appetite for sex, which was often violent and non-consensual. Peter Nygaard's MO was to meet beautiful women, sometimes broken beautiful women, and lure them into his jet-setting life with the promise of modeling contracts, parties, and often free housing. But it wasn't long before the women realized that beyond the freebies and underneath all that flamboyant charisma and the long, flowing, feathered blonde hair was a monster who fed on sex, dominance, and utter control.
My name is Jennifer Gilmer, and I was a victim of Peter Nygaard.
I sat down with Jenny Gilmer to talk to her about what she says happened to her at Peter Nygaard's luxury resort home in the Bahamas. Thank you so much for doing this. I know this is not easy, and so I'm very appreciative. It's hard for me even to ask the questions because I feel like it's so invasive, but I think it's important to hear your story. Tell me about your experience with Peter Nygaard.
Well, it was, seems so long ago now. Sometimes it feels long ago. Sometimes it feels like yesterday. I just turned 19. I was vacationing in the Bahamas, in Nassau, with my family, and I just graduated, and I was spending the summer in the Bahamas, just, you know, enjoying myself before I went, you know, back to Canada to go to college. And yeah, I was sailing, and my mother was there, and my younger brother. During that time, I started taking tennis lessons. And my mother's boyfriend at the time, who lived in the Bahamas, actually introduced me to this tennis coach, and kind of, you know, was the one that suggested that I start taking tennis lessons. So I thought it was a great idea. So I did. And then this tennis instructor, he started taking me to Niagara Key. First, he started talking about a gentleman called Peter Nygaard, and that he would like to play tennis with me sometime. And then he started taking me to Niagara Key to play tennis. That was the first time I met him.
So you meet Peter Nygaard at Niagara Key. I'm imagining that you're seeing this opulent resort-like home, and it's pretty overwhelming as a 19-year-old.
Yes, especially a 19-year-old from a small town in New Brunswick. It was nothing like I'd ever seen. Everyone was very nice. I thought everything was a little strange as well.
How did things go from being a 19-year-old tennis guest who'd been introduced to Peter by your tennis coach to a situation where you found yourself literally being raped? When I ask that, it seems so invasive, but at the same time, I think so many people don't understand how quickly things can turn. So to the best of your ability, describe how all of a sudden he went from being this, you know, generous host to being a predator.
I feel like it was a little bit different for me. I wasn't that girl that was, you know, promised work or modeling gigs or anything like that. That was never my aspiration. There was never a thought in my mind to model or anything like that. And those weren't things that were promised to me by him at all. It was just me being left there by my tennis coach. And I was just, you know, an easy target. I don't even think I was his type during that time. I mean, he would have been in his, you know, 60s. I guess this is in the 90s. And I was just this kind of short, you know, kind of plump 19-year-old. But he did take me to his bedroom. All of the rooms at Niagara Key are like tree houses. They're kind of all over the place. And he has his on the very top level. And it's all glass. And we walked in, and he took me in there to get a drink. He wanted to show me around. When the doors close, everything's locked. It's all glass. You can see out, but no one can see in. And he has a code system on it, and it was locked. When you go in to the property, there is security. And they just do a security check, and my passport was taken. I was a naive girl from the East Coast of Canada, so why would I think that's a problem or a big deal? I'd never experienced anything like that.
And so the whole time you were there, you did not have your passport?
I did not.
So he took you to his bedroom to ostensibly tour you around, and what happened next?
That day, he had suggested to my tennis coach that he wanted me to wear a dress. And I thought that was very strange to wear a dress to play tennis. But I did. And so he brought me over to the bed and asked me to sit down. And at this point, I was feeling a little lightheaded. We had a couple of drinks at the court. And I just felt tired. I felt a little fuzzy. I wasn't a big drinker, so I didn't really know what was happening to me at that point. He proceeded to, you know, to lift up my dress, and I asked him to stop, and he did not. And then he forced himself on me, and I. you know, screamed for him to stop, and he did not. And at that point, I didn't have a lot of strength, and I don't know. I didn't see him put anything in my drink, but I did not have a lot of strength, and everything just seemed a lot harder than it should be. And for, you know, for a man of his age, he's actually very strong. And I wasn't a very big person either. And unfortunately, he did rape me, but he sodomized me. And that was probably the worst pain that I have ever experienced and ever want to experience. And that is kind of the day that my life changed. And I went numb.
I imagine a lot of people don't understand that, especially when you're, you know, so young at 19, there's a part of you that just freezes because it's all happening in real time. It's all fine and dandy to look back on it and question anything. But if you're in a circumstance that is playing out in real time, you really just don't know how to react because you're not sure if your reactions are going to be more problematic than the instance you're in.
That's right. And I was very ashamed. And I think at that point, it's very hard not to blame yourself because you put yourself in that situation. And I was never a girl that, you know, dressed revealingly, or, you know, I was always very, you know, conservative and preppy. And I was never that girl. And for me, I felt like I was at that point. I felt disgusting. I felt ashamed and embarrassed. And those are not the feelings you should have when you're a victim, but we do. And I think for a lot of people, they don't say anything because they're ashamed, embarrassed. You know, they wouldn't want their family to know what had just happened to them. People will look at me differently. And I could not handle that. I was there for about, I was kept there for about 3 weeks. And I was forced not only to be with him, but to be with other people. And I turned myself off.
Tell me about that notion. You know, again, people will be confused. You didn't ask to leave right away. Why wouldn't you say, get me my passport? I need to get out of here. People won't understand the mentality or the feeling or the fear and why you would stay and how you ended up even again with Peter or with others.
Right, right. And that makes sense. You know, I actually did try to leave. I don't know. You know, Nigar Key is in its own gated, you know, area. And then Lyford Key is actually the community which is another gated area that he lived in. So there was two gates to go through. I did manage to get my hands on a golf cart one day. And I tried to go. It didn't go so well. I was turned back. And I mean, where am I going to go? I have no money on me. Everything was taken and I don't have a passport. And you know, my experience that I had had with the Bahamian police force, while I was there, even before I met Peter, I had been pulled over and by a police officer and,
bit scary.
Didn't trust them either. There was so many staff members. They were very kind to me. And you know, before that, Peter was as well. No matter how eccentric he was, I thought that was, it was kind of funny in the beginning, and then he just very quickly became a monster that I was terrified of.
Terrified of this violent sadomasochist. But Peter Nygaard's sex crimes got even darker. Victim after victim describe his enclave in the Bahamas as a place where he trafficked dozens and dozens of women and girls, even to his friends.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You touched on the fact that he had trafficked you to others as well while you were there. Tell me about that.
Peter would have parties. He would fly people in from the States, from Miami, people apparently that he had met at swingers clubs and things like that. I didn't even know what a swingers club was until that summer. He would have parties of his grotto. And that's kind of where things started. And he would tell me to be with certain people. And I didn't know where to go or hide. So I did what he told me to do because I turned myself off and I was terrified.
He had all the power.
He did. In those moments, when I had to be with other people, I felt safer than any other time I was there because I didn't have to be with him. Because he was violent, to be sodomized by a monster, I would take having sex or being raped by a stranger than having that. And it's a horrible way to compare, but that is how I felt at the time.
Jenny, this is decades later, and it's so palpable that you're still, suffering the residual PTSD from what you've been through. It's such a platitude to say, how are you? But I truly do want to know, how are you? Are you going to be okay? Are things getting better?
Are things getting better? I don't... That's a very... full question. I do the best I can. It honestly is day by day. I, for a long time, didn't want to have kids because, well, there's a lot of evil in this world. There's a lot of bad things and bad people out there. And I didn't think I wanted to bring kids into that. And so I was pretty close to 40 when I started having my kids because I couldn't bear bringing children into a world that I knew could be so evil. And how do I protect them? I can't keep them in bubble wrap, and protect them from the world their whole lives. I can't do that. But I can teach them. I can teach them tools to protect themselves.
How did you eventually get out of Nygard Key?
I think it was mid-August. Everybody, there was just a lot of kind of chaos around the property. People were packing up. And then I heard that Nygard was leaving. He was going back to the mainland, to the States, I think, and to one of his other properties. And so when he leaves, everybody has to leave. So he gave me my passport back, and I was able to go. And it was such a, that was a scary day too, because I was like, well, who am I now? I leave this property where do I go from here? I knew my plans for the fall to, go back to Canada, go to school, but who am I? So I got my passport and I left, and I didn't tell anybody until I think I was probably 31 or 32. I left and just kind of turned something off inside of me and pretended it didn't happen, because how could I move on with my life holding on to something like that? But I think when you push things back, you can only push them back so far. It affected my whole life. I've had two divorces. I have lost some friends along the way. It just affected me for how I can trust. I have trust issues, and it's really, really difficult. So it did. I didn't really push it back. I just didn't deal with it. And maybe if I said something when I left, that my life would have been a little different. I can't really change that now, but I also have, my two wonderful children, and the life that we have created, which is wonderful. But I think my life would have been different. And I think the I would have dealt with the trauma differently because it is hard to go to sleep at night.
Jenny Gilmer is one of potentially thousands of NIGARD victims. Her lawyer, Greg Gutzler, represents 135, and they have all signed on to a class action suit against him.
I had no idea what I was getting into. I was invited to the Bahamas to meet some people, and right when I got there and walked into this conference room, the tone, the atmosphere, the intensity was palpable. And I realized I'd walked into something that was going to truly change my life, and it did. And I've been dedicated to this for about 6 years. So yes, I've talked to hundreds of people. I've talked to my amazing clients like Jenny. So it has changed my life.
If you had to describe Peter NIGARD in a sentence, what would that sentence be?
He's a narcissistic serial predator who uses people around him to get everything he wants, and to then put people into a position of silence by intimidating them.
And when they approach you and tell you their stories, is there much variance between their experiences, or is there like a classic MO that they all describe separately?
There is a classic MO, but some of the ways in which he implemented his scheme was a little different. When he was younger, he was using more physical force, and he was very violent. And you'll hear stories about that, and you probably read our complaint where there was a lot of physical violence. As he got older, he started to use different type of mechanics where he would recruit young women, and he would often abuse them, but he would then use them to lure people in. He would then become much more manipulative. He was figuring out ways to coerce them by defrauding them, by promising them things, more like the Harvey Weinstein type of approach, where if you do this, I'll get you a career. I'm going to make all your dreams come true. I'll be the father figure you never had.
What is the age range of the alleged victims at the time they were assaulted?
Ages 14 was the youngest that I know of. And in terms of the oldest, I don't recall any client of mine who was assaulted over the age of maybe 35 or so. So NIGARD was looking for younger women and girls. They're terrified. And the reason is because he's an older white male with fame. He did have power and he had political influence. He also gave off an air of, I will do whatever it takes to get away with it. So when you have that combined with the social dynamics, the cultural barriers to people reporting, you have a wildly disparate power imbalance. You have young women, girls under the age of 18, often from impoverished backgrounds, without a support system. No one's going to believe them. And he preyed on that. He knew that they were facing so many barriers and so many obstacles. And he was scary because I think he demonstrated he would do anything.
To the best of your knowledge, what was Peter NIGARD's typical targets? And as I understand it, it changed through the ages, through the decades. He had a certain type in his 40s, 50s, maybe even 60s, and that morphed. What's your knowledge of that?
Right. So it did morph, and I don't really understand the reason for that. But he did move to black and brown women. And before that, he was more whatever he could find. And that was in the Canadian area and Winnipeg, Toronto, Montreal, as well as in Los Angeles. So you were finding a different demographic. And my clients range very much in race as well as their age. And real common factor was wherever he could find a victim, he would exploit that opportunity. And he was using people around him to recruit people to keep coming in and coming in. So part of it was the demographics of his recruiters as well.
It sounds like the same MO of Jeffrey Epstein.
The difference there is that Epstein used one or two recruiters. NIGARD used dozens, if not hundreds, of recruiters over the years to help him meet young women. And the women would feel more comfortable meeting somebody who was of their age, their race, who was being promised something exciting like a career. And that's how he really did it. So yes, he had a lot of people more than Epstein did.
I oscillate between the terms victim and survivor. I think calling people who've endured Peter's wrath survivors is important. For purposes of, jurisprudence, the term is typically victim. So everyone will have to forgive me if I go between these victims and survivor terminology. To be clear, and this is hard for, I think, a lot of people to understand, victims who end up recruiting others, there is a very different definition, a very different notion about, mens rea or culpability. And I'd just love to hear your legal perspective on that.
You've just hit on the most complex issue in the case. And I don't necessarily mean legally, though that's obviously an interesting issue. Psychologically, it is the most interesting issue to approach in the case because there are certainly dozens of Nygaard victims that became recruiters. And that puts, you talk about mens rea or the legal terminology, there is a certain degree of confusion there. And I think law enforcement is understandably confused by that. What do you do with that person when you have, let's say she was 16 and she was absolutely tortured, brutally victimized, and as a way to survive, where she has no other way out, she turns to bringing in other people for Nygaard.
But I can see how he was able to co-opt a lot of people into his orb. And then I can also see how he browbeat certain people as well. There's a degree, I think you mentioned it, of psychological torture that he exacted on victims and people who worked for him.
There's no question, and it built up. So he created massive incentives to make him happy and to not upset him. And he created massive disincentives to keep you from veering from his path. And it would be so unpleasant that I think people were truly in a PTSD type of survival mode. And when you're trying so desperately to avoid being browbeaten, as you said, and that's probably a nice way of putting it, he would be brutally vindictive. And he would retaliate so harshly that he would do anything to survive. And so I can understand people in survival mode, particularly people that are in compromised situations, will do what it takes, because on the other side of that, as you said, is the magnanimity and the generosity and the loving father figure that he could portray. He would convey to them, you're home, you're safe, come with me, but you need to do what I'm asking you to do. And if you don't, there will be harsh repercussions. So when you have that double-sided coin, you're going to do what you have to do to survive. And that's why I can understand why people got caught in these situations and did things that after they're deprogrammed, and I mean that literally deprogrammed, they think that was a totally different human being. That wasn't me. I was trying desperately to survive. I would never do that in my right mind, but I was terrified. I had no other choice. I had no real choice. And that's what you hear a lot. I had no choice.
There were so many people, who came in and out of his life in whatever capacity. Sometimes they were girlfriends who ended up as employees, family members, longtime staff members. And they almost look dead in the eyes when they talk about their experiences there.
You're right. I think there's a certain degree of numbness. And I think you'll see, Ashley, as they come out of it, they start to become sad. Then they get angry. And then you see the numbness go away. You see the passion come out to think, I cannot believe how you compromised me. I cannot believe what you did to me. I cannot believe the things that you made me do. People ask me, how did this happen for so long? Why do some people want to refuse to believe it? I've actually got a theory on that, not a legal theory. My theory is that some people don't want to believe there is that type of evil in this world, because they couldn't even go about their day if they knew what Jenny and I know and what you know when these people are all around us.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
What do you think about the accusation that you should have known?
I think that that's been a very, like, an unfair one. Because, yes, I did know a lot, but everybody should have known then. If I should have known, every single person in the company should have known. Every executive should have known. Every person that sat in a budget meeting that saw the line items and in his personal column of the different girls that he was paying a part of the payroll should have known. We all knew there were girls who were sleeping with him that had positions in the company and were also having sex with Peter. So everybody knew that.
Things changed over the years, right? Maybe not in the 80s, maybe not even so much in the 90s, but certainly in the 2000s, we started to realize with the complaints of sexual harassment in the workplace, did it dawn on him at any time? Hey, maybe I better pull back.
I don't think so. I do not believe it did. I think people would tell him. I think other executives and
would warn him.
Would start saying, hey, I think you're kind of pushing the envelope, or I think this is a little too much.
How do you react?
He would be. He couldn't be told no on it. He would. He reacts violently and violent opposition to anything anybody says.
So not only can you not tell him that,
yeah,
he will verbally abuse you for telling him something he needs to know,
or shun you, or fire you, or you know, there's like he's the battery of the minute you stand up against him or say anything against him or challenge him, and because he would look at that as a challenge, saying, hey, I don't think you should answer the door naked. He would look at that as a challenge. And then it would be your problem. It wind up something would be your fault about that statement. And inevitably, you'd either be berated or you'd be let go. You'd be changed offices. So, I mean, that alone is a form of sexual harassment.
If you stood up to him, you were in for it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Even with helpful advice.
Even with helpful advice. With advice, you're trying to, you know, and he.
Like, help me help you.
Yeah.
And that was met with a verbal barrage.
Yeah, if you use the term the law, that was one of his pet peeves. I mean, that would just set him over the edge every time. He had very little respect for the law. He thought he could manipulate the law. The law was something that he knows better than lawyers. Lawyers are the worst people. So if you...
His tunnel vision was so rigid that if you even dared to give him a warning about how the law would look at what he was doing, you were the problem.
Exactly. And then, because he thinks that then, because, I mean, the multiple lawsuits too. I mean, we were, you know, obviously the criminal and sexual ones, the class civil action or class action in the U.S. in the last, you know, 5 years, 4 years, are so in the news. But there were hundreds of other little lawsuits on all different, and if it wasn't Peter getting sued, it was Peter suing people.
You didn't see the narcissism all the way along?
I don't think narcissist meant you look. No, I did not understand what a narcissist was until somebody told me that's what Peter was.
And then you look back at the 90s and you know?
And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's in every category. One day there will be a new category of narcissist that combines all of them and you've got Peter's face next to it.
A Nygaardicist.
The Nygaard Empire went into a free fall in 2020. That's when the accusers started coming forward in full force. Their allegations date back as far as the 1970s, and some women say they were as young as 14 and 15 when they were raped. Nygaard's New York City headquarters, that was raided by the FBI as part of a criminal sex trafficking investigation. Nygaard was soon arrested and charged, both in Canada and the U.S., but he wasn't the only one to implode. His niece, Angela Dyborn, my childhood best friend, had been on and off the payroll for Nygaard for decades. She ran Uncle Peter's Los Angeles home and his office, and she was at his beck and call night and day. When his world began to crumble, so did hers. But in ways that she never expected.
You know, the bankruptcy was coming down. The class action civil suit was starting to cascade. The criminal charges were all coming in. Where did you kind of fit into all that, and what did you think was going to happen to you?
I didn't think anything. I really, through all this time, and especially through all my work, believed I was doing a job, I was working for Peter, Peter controlled everything, and that I wasn't doing anything illegal.
So you didn't think that you had exposure?
I didn't think I had exposure at all.
You kind of watched from the outside thinking, this is horrible, you know, we're all going to lose our jobs, etc., but you didn't think that your livelihood was about to be destroyed.
I didn't think my life was going to be destroyed. I really didn't. I mean, of course, I knew people. I knew I've been around, but I, you know, I even like at first I was like, wait, this is all being fabricated. This isn't real. What's happening here?
You thought you'd lose your job. That's it.
Yeah. And many other people lose their jobs. The world that we were cast into in the legal system was beyond anything I could have ever imagined.
The first thing that kind of hits your doorstep is you're sued by one of his accusers. And it's not a small lawsuit.
Got a demand letter at first for $25 million, which I know are kind of geared to get your attention so you respond.
Oh, $25 million would get anyone's attention.
A $25 million lawsuit accusing Angela of setting up a former model to be sexually assaulted by Peter Nygaard. Angela was called, quote, a key cog in Nygaard's vast sex trafficking network. The suit claimed that the model was assaulted in Winnipeg, Canada, while Angela was in charge of Nygaard's Los Angeles home. It was filed in California in November of 2020, and it alleged that Angela personally lured victims for Nygaard to rape, that she paid victims hush money, and that she transported them to get abortions and be treated for sexually transmitted diseases.
What was the allegation that landed on your doorstep in the civil suit?
That I had arranged to have somebody come work for Peter under the guise of modeling, that I picked them up at the airport in Winnipeg in November in 93, that I delivered them to Peter, I left them there, and that the person was raped and held by Peter for a number of days.
Against her will.
Yeah, against her will.
The allegation that was made against you in this lawsuit was that you had facilitated the transport of a person to what she believed was a modeling interview, and she alleges was 3 days of captivity and rape.
Correct.
When the lawsuit was filed, it made huge headlines, and Angela's life collapsed. She and her children were shunned in the community and at their school. Friends dropped away, jobs were lost, the family became virtual pariahs. What didn't get press was that soon after the suit was filed, it was withdrawn by the accuser, which seemed confusing. If Angela was such a key part of Nygaard's operation, had she played any role in facilitating his crimes? To answer that question, it's important to know what Nygaard's empire was like, how his employees were also considered victims of a sadistic and ruthless tyrant, a tyrant who exacted psychological and financial control throughout his corporate landscape.
But you're also to be in that circle and to be part of that, especially in kind of that tighter circle, you're also a victim. You're also somebody that's being equally not raped, thank goodness. You know, I was a victim, not a rape victim, which I can't even imagine what that situation
that suffering is.
I mean,
like,
it's just a different level, but you're absolutely victims.
And then there's the added complication of being both an employee and a family member in a family that was always fiercely loyal to Peter Nygaard, and mostly blind to his ugly side.
I asked forensic psychiatrist Dr. Julian Goger for his perspective on the people who enabled Nygaard.
Peter Nygaard's extended family, they always circled the wagons and they always protected Peter. They always believed that the rumors of transgressions were those who were coming for him, and that he was the victim. Does it make sense to you that a family would behave this way? Because a lot of critics believe that his family enabled him.
Yeah, but if you're going to talk about enabling, we have to talk about what were the family's perceptions about him. Did they understand a person truly? So it would be wrong for us to draw a conclusion and blame family members if we don't know where the family members were coming from. And sometimes things evolve, but at what point in time did things change? And did people see the change? And how did people react to the changes? And when the changes were on the cusp of breaking the law, did family members see that?
And would it be normal for them to disbelieve it before believing it?
It's not only the people around him, but family members also can be brainwashed into believing something until the external world says, hey, it ain't the way you saw it. And then reality sets in.
Does your therapist say that you're like a PTSD victim? Or does your therapist sort of categorize this for you, like what you're living?
Absolutely PTSD. Trauma. I mean, there is trauma involved. I didn't think about it at the time, and it wasn't necessarily from the beginning days, but through this course of the last, 40 years, being so tied to his life, being a family member, and being very much in that inner circle of his life.
Jesus Christ, you just continue to run around with these fucking excuses. What don't you get?
There's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of just shutting down and forgetting. I'm still, though, not the same kind of victim as Peter. So I feel guilty almost feeling bad about this. I'm at the point where, our life is devastated, but I feel guilty even feeling bad, because there's so much worse that he's done to other people that I can still one day move away, change my name, move on.
It's f***ing chaotic, Angela. It is f***ing chaotic. The way you and
Morton
run that place.
Were Angela and other NIGARD employees accomplices or victims? You may think you know, but before casting judgment, you're going to want to hear the things that Peter said and did to all of them.
What the f*** was the picture all about? F*** me. Jesus Christ, you guys are f***ing ignorant.
A tyrant of epic proportions. On the next episode of Uncle Peter.
I heard you say that 3 times now.
You've been listening to Uncle Peter, a Drop Dead Serious podcast. If you or someone you know has been a victim of sexual assault, please, please call your local sexual assault hotline.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.